This podcast is brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.
This is Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag with your host, Misha Zielinski.
G'day, welcome to Diplomates. I'm Misha. This week I caught up with Claire O'Neill. Claire is the Labor Shadow Minister for Senior Australians and Aged Care Services. A qualified lawyer with a background in business consulting, Claire is a Fulbright scholar and a graduate from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. I caught up with Claire for a chinwag about how we can make working work for people, why we need to rediscover class in our political discourse, Australia's guest worker visa disaster, the short-term obsessions undermining our policymaking, how we can bring tech giants to heel, and ways we can improve the culture of our politics. It's a really fascinating chat. I hope you enjoy it. Ever since Claire first lobbed on the scene as the youngest woman to be elected as a mayor in Australian history, she's been a rising superstar in Australian politics. And this chat really shows why Claire is so highly rated by so many people. Claire is also a fellow podcaster, so I want to give a shout out to her podcast, The Long View, which focuses on long-term policy challenges and in particular recovering from COVID-19. As ever, if you are enjoying our little show here at Diplomates, please rate, review and share it with people. It really helps spread the word and it does bend the algorithm our way so it gets the show in front of more people. Without further discussion from me, enjoy the episode. Claire O'Neill, welcome to Diplomates. How are you?
I'm so good, Misha. How are you doing?
I am well. Thank you for joining us. Now, always plenty of places to start, but as a fellow podcaster, I thought I'd give you the ultimate easy Dixer, personal plug, your podcast, The Long View. I was thinking about this as I was sort of preparing the interview and I was thinking, well, firstly, we've got to get the plug in for your podcast, podcaster to podcaster, but also, why the title? Why did you select that title? And then secondly, you were sort of podcasting throughout the COVID, 2020. What was there one big takeaway that you learned from all the interviews that you did of a lot of, different eminent thinkers in Australia?
Yeah. Well, thanks for the free plug for The Long View. Love a bit of Labor Party cross promotion, Misha. So this podcast I started really when we went into lockdown in Melbourne, and we were kind of, as you know, in and out of lockdown for pretty much most of 2020. And so I had lots of time to be talking to people and thinking about things, which I don't normally in my work as a member of Parliament. And I called the podcast The Long View really for two reasons. I think the first is I have just an ongoing fundamental frustration with the obsession of Australian politics on the short-term stuff that goes on. It is just amazing how much time and energy gets focused on whatever the kind of micro-political debate of the day is. And I just don't think that's our job. I mean, it is part of our job. Of course, we've got to keep the government accountable and or manage the issues of the day. But fundamentally, we're here to make sure that the best things about Australia are being delivered for the next generation. And those are all questions that are about the long term, not what happens in politics today or tomorrow, but what we're doing in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years. So it's that general interest. But also with COVID, I really noticed there was, of course, obsessive focus of a lot of senior people on the pandemic. That was totally appropriate. And I just felt I could actually probably contribute to the conversation because I wasn't involved in that, actual sort of emergency management of the health issue. I could help out a little bit by thinking about some of the issues that I thought were going to be different because of COVID in the long term. So that was really where we got to.
Was there one big thing that you sort of like the big theme that you took away from all the different conversations that you had on that?
Yeah, I mean, there were so many. We had 17 hours of conversation with experts. One thing I would just say is I think coming out of COVID, there's a real temptation both on the right and the left of politics to be this is the moment where everyone realises that we were right all along, all of our, thinking about how we approach the world. And it became, I think, for some people a little bit utopian that, suddenly the public were going to emerge believing in a whole bunch of stuff they hadn't believed before. And I'm like you, Misha, very pragmatic. I'm quite a centrist person. And I really...
Careful. I'm a bleeding heart liberal. You offend my listeners. No.
I am a bleeding heart, absolutely. But I also believe in representative politics and I believe in listening to my community. And I So one of the things I just came out of that feeling is, you know, there is a huge reform opportunity coming from COVID. There's no question about that. I don't think, though, you can kind of label it as a progressive left reform opportunity, but there's big stuff that can change here. And just one of the ones that I would throw into the mix, which I think's gotten almost no airplay when it deserves a huge amount of focus, is immigration. We've got immigration on hold in this country for the first time really ever.
Yeah.
And I mean, we had net negative migration flows for a brief period around the war, but this is a huge opportunity for us to actually Absolutely. Stand back and say, is this serving our interests? Do we want immigration rates where they are? And do we want the mix of people coming in to be the way it was? And I think we've got to be real here. There's real issues with our immigration system. Why wouldn't we take the chance now to rebuild that system from scratch?
A fantastic point. I mean, we could do a whole show on immigration, but I mean, I think a lot of people would be shocked that, you know, there's a lot of talk about the permanent number, you know, is it 160,000, yeah. is it 170,000? But when we were pre-COVID, it was that made up 10% of the overall yeah. migration intake, which I think would shock a lot of people about how many guest workers we had and the temporary migration that the country come through alive.
Yeah, absolutely, Misha. And it's a very big change for Australia. That program was never designed to be a temporary worker scheme, which is in some ways what it's become. We've always had an approach to immigration in Australia that's been around permanency and citizenship because yep. we're this beautiful multicultural country because totally. We welcome people in and we make them and they become Australian and they're our neighbours and they're equal. But the way the immigration system works at the moment, it's not like that. And we had pre-COVID almost 1 million people in the country who were not citizens, who didn't have a clear pathway to citizenship, and who were here basically to work and then they'd go home again. And that's just, I don't think that's a good migration program for our country. I don't think it's consistent with our national values. So that's just one area where I feel like it's not a right or a left issue, but there's a clear space for a big conversation and I would like us to have it.
I completely agree. And I think it's one that Labor should lean into. Now, speaking of, as you said, centrist pragmatism, it's time to me to get my plug in. Now, obviously, the right stuff. it's been in the news. You were a contributor to it. So if you haven't bought it, listeners, make sure you buy one copy and one for your friend. That way I will double my sales. But, you know, it was an attempt, you know, from we had 30 contributors from across the Labor movement, but also particularly, you know, the National Uni, Centre Unity, the right. The more perhaps moderate, pragmatic wing of the Labor movement. Your essay, so I want to dig into your essay specifically. It's a great essay. Obviously, the best essay was my essay, but yours was the second best essay.
Okay.
No, but all jokes aside,
yours was your guess, but
that's exactly right. No, yours was a fantastic contribution essentially about making work work, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of curious about what you meant by that and why do you think work is no longer delivering for people in the way that it once did.
Yeah, thanks, Misha. And The Right Stuff really is a really great book and I want to congratulate you on it because, you know, you can get these collections of essays that don't quite work, but this one was awesome, like really good thinking from really interesting people. So I think it's a good read and I would encourage everyone to buy it.
Print that on a T-shirt, right?
Yeah. So the essay I wrote for The Right Stuff was about work and so, Misha, if we just kind of roll back a bit, like the purpose of our political party is about work, really. It's about how do we use work to share the prosperity of Australia with all Australians. And for a long time, that has been the ideal model for sharing the benefits of growth with ordinary people. But it's not working anymore. Like, it is actually fundamentally broken. And for the Labor Party, this is a huge crisis because we need to basically rethink what our model is going to be for sharing the benefits of growth. There is no point to economic growth unless ordinary people improve their quality of life. I'm sure you and I agree on that. So my piece was really about what's changed and why isn't work working anymore and what can we do to fix it.
So what was what would you say is the biggest problem? I mean, I completely agree with your sort of your analysis that it's no longer delivering for people in terms of security, in terms of wages growth and sort of that, you know, pre-distributive element of the economy, which is, you know, essentially taking out the tax system or how do people get ahead by having a good, secure job with good wages?
Yeah.
You know, what are the pillars that have sort of fallen apart there in your diagnosis?
If I could just describe it in one sentence, it's that we've had dramatic economic change over the past 40 years that hasn't been partnered with sufficient other policy shifts to help Australians cope with what's changed. But if you just unpack that a little bit, so the labour market today looks completely different to how it did when Bob Hawke was elected Prime Minister in 1983. So what one of the things we can see, for example, is that incomes growth is gone really wonky, and people who are working at the lower end of the labour market are getting no income growth at all, and people at the upper end are getting massive growth in income. So just instantly we have a huge inequality problem that's built into the labour market. The thing that's also changing is the kind of places in the economy where jobs are growing is different. So what we're seeing is we're getting lots of jobs growth for really high skill, university educated people. We're getting a lot of jobs growth for low skill people who are generally really poorly paid and have really difficult conditions attached to their work. And those middle ring of jobs, and especially in manufacturing, an area of major passion for you, they're not growing fast enough, or in some cases actually going into decline. So we're ending up with this labour market where there's, you can either be kind of have lots of money and be rich, you can have not much and struggle all the time, and that middle rung is sort of disappearing. And just a final thing I just mentioned is the declining quality of jobs that basically has happened in particular this last 8 years of the Liberal government. Gig economy employs a million people today, and their employment conditions are totally precarious. But even across like the caring professions, which is an issue that predominantly affects women, you know, it is scandalous the way that some people are treated in the labour market. And yeah, so we've got a big job ahead of us when Labor's next elected to government to address some of these issues and make work work again.
Yeah, so I kind of want to dig into that, because I think one of the big conversations people have tended to obsess about, certainly for the last 5 years, maybe the last 10 years, is the future of work, automation challenge. Oh, we're not going to have jobs. Are we going to need a UBI, et cetera? Are you someone that believe, you and I have talked about this before, but I'm kind of curious to get your thoughts on, the so-called jobless future, and do we need to have all these kind of, new policies, or do you think it's a little bit more simple? Because what you sort of talked about there is this sort of splitting away of the reward elements of work and who gets rewarded and what work gets rewarded. I mean, my view is, I personally have the view that the evidence supports that we don't have a job creation problem. Jobs are being created. What we have is a conditions replacement problem. And what I mean by that is you live in a regional city, you lose your job at a factory, at a steelworks, at an oil refinery, you lose your job. It's well paid. It's probably earning six figures. And it's secure work. It's got, leave, sick leave, holiday pay, et cetera. And suddenly you're driving Uber with completely unregulated labour conditions. And so you've got a job per se, but you're not, the conditions are nothing like that. And so, I mean, are you someone that worries about that automation challenge, or do you see it more in that kind of, how do we actually make people get rewarded for the work they're doing in all those categories you listed?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree with your analysis of that there, Misha. And I think if we kind of roll back around like 10 years, that's when there was a genuine frenzy. And these frenzies sort of rise up and down over history if you look back, that, there's going to be a jobless future and basically we're all going to have to be on universal basic incomes. Yeah. And, it's just, but the thing is, it just never plays out. Like we watch it and technology destroys jobs, and it also creates jobs.
Yeah, that's right. And it's funny though, right? I mean, sorry to cut across you. I mean, blue collar people have been suffering from automation for ever. Yeah. Suddenly accountants were going to get automated and everyone sort of freaked out, right? Yeah. Which is sort of amusing, I suppose, if you're a blue collar person.
They know all about it, don't they?
Yeah.
So I think the big thing for us is, firstly, that the new jobs that are getting created are good jobs, a lot of them. But they require skills that the people that got displaced by robotics don't have. And the second thing is that it's gone along with this real push to devalue work for people who don't have a lot of education. And so those two things combined mean that we end up with this labour market where, if you're an IT guru or, a fancy lawyer or any of those jobs, you are fine. Like, this is not affecting you. But the impact on people who didn't get to study much beyond high school in particular is acute, and we can see that really clearly. And we can see it not just in the economic figures, Misha, but in politics. Like, the frustration that people have because this is like the biggest problem in their lives, and they feel like people aren't talking about it enough and representing them enough on these issues. So, yeah, again, like this is a problem that Labor's going to solve, not the Liberals. And so we do need a federal Labor government to come in and be a long-term government that can actually structurally fix some of these problems.
Yeah. So, I mean, you just touched on a couple of interesting areas there, and you've done work in this. So I want to sort of dig into this challenge of, you know, you've done a lot of analysis of how displacement has affected in particular blue-collar men. And, and so, you know, what do you see that's happening to that cohort in particular? And then, you know, economically, but then also politically, right? Because
you see
it in the United States, important. Certainly, the biggest, where you saw this shock of manufacturing losses and a shock of job losses for blue-collar communities and blue-collar men, and that's where the biggest support for Trumpism emerged, right? So you're right that those two things are sort of correlated, but you know what is happening to that particular sort of group of people?
And it's a really good question, and there's sort of weird sensitivities sometimes around talking about men and the issues they face at work, Misha, because like I think that the starting point for this conversation is in Australia people probably don't think about this much, but we actually have a very gender defined labor market. So there are jobs where women are really, really dominant: nursing, aged care, all the caring professions, teaching, lots of other ones. There are jobs where men are really, really dominant. And the impact of that is that the experience of Australian men and women at work is actually quite different. And for women, the biggest issue they face is job quality and the fact that there's a lot of women congregated in poorly paid professions where the conditions are not fair. And that's a problem that Labor's talked about a lot and we need to solve. When you look at men, the situation's quite different. And the real problem for men is that there are structural changes happening to our economy that are leading these jobs that used to be enough to support a family, and they're just disappearing. So it's not just an economic crisis for a lot of men. It's a cultural crisis as well, because a lot of men and a lot of communities still have this really strong attachment to a male breadwinner model of a family. And in fact, you know, like I'm a feminist, I just have to look at the facts. Like that is the dominant family structure for Australians. And I think we are really, I think it's really unfair to not have a sort of open discussion about what that feels like for men who are raised to believe that their job is to provide for their family, and then they get into a labour market where they find they actually can't do that. But also just on the economic side, like this is a real crisis. And a lot of the blokes that you work with, Misha, in your union, they would see people around them losing jobs sometimes and, as you say, not able to find a job that pays them well, that's secure on the other side of that. So when we look at the numbers, what we really see for men is for men who didn't get the chance to study, their participation rates in work are actually plummeting. And it's actually, the numbers are quite scary. So if you look at, like, one of the things that sort of frustrates me about the debate about men and work is that people put all men in the same bucket, and it's like, you know, there's this sort of kings of the world narrative. And if you're a really highly educated man, you're probably on average doing really, really well, and you're actually the best, kind of in the best position in the labour market of any group of Australians. But lots of Australian men don't fit into that category. And even today, 25% of Australian young men don't finish high school. Like these are the men I'm talking about, and that's like 40% of the men who are of working age in Australia today. So I think we've really got to have a big think about some fundamental questions here. What are lower skill men in Australia going to do in the future, where robotics have displaced a lot of the jobs that they would traditionally have done? And a really important question for me is, we've got a school system that doesn't really provide proper support to young boys who are not academic, who are never going to go onto university and never follow that pathway. And I think we need to do a lot of thinking about how we can help those guys get set up in the skills system, get set up in a job that's going to give them a fulfilling life, when a lot of them today are actually falling through the cracks.
Yeah, and so it's really interesting, obviously critical policy challenge, but politically, you sort of talked about it before that, you know, perhaps there's this frustration building in the community, particularly in the people that you just sort of mentioned. But, you know, one of the things I wrote about in the right stuff is that we've stopped talking about class. And I think as a result, you know, when we talk about if it's identity based on gender, for example, you say, okay, well, all men are the same and all women are the same. We know that's not true, right? And so there's no, like, a person who has a is a cleaner who lives in a regional community is not going to have much in common with an inner city banker. All right. Mm. And so if we sort of put people into that stream altogether, it becomes very difficult to have a conversation. People don't relate to it.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you see that challenge from the Labor Party's point of view, actually connecting in a way that people can sort of build sort of, I suppose, solidarity around their challenge?
Yeah. Mm. I think it's a really, really important point, Misha. And I do think that, I think in the Labor Party, class is always there. It's always part of the discussion and it's kind of a core thing for us. But if I look at the broader conversation about, I don't even know how you describe it, society and economy that's happening outside of the party, I think it's become a little bit dominated by people whose main focus is on gender and it is on race. And those things are really important. Like, don't get me wrong, they're super important. But there's a blindness almost amongst that group to class. And, it's the people that you and I care about most, I think I can say this, they're not on Twitter tweeting about, you know, whatever the issue of the day is. They're in their communities struggling, trying to make ends meet. And they're actually can't even access this conversation, nor would they really want to, that's happening at this really highfalutin level. And I just feel for myself, those are the people I represent in Parliament because they don't have a voice. And there's a lot of people who are very loud in the conversation who are, I think, missing some really important pieces.
And so we can talk about that a lot, but we're obviously going to cover some other topics. But I encourage people to read my chapter to get my thoughts on this challenge. But one of the things that, you know, the sort of the elephant in the room in this challenge, right, is, there's this automation challenges, this sort of breakdown of work, there's this, the skills challenge, but there's also this sort of big theme that's happened or this big policy wave of technology, right? And mm-hmm. So particularly around digital platforms. I want to get your take. I mean, we've had this big spat between the government and Facebook, particularly over media regulation, et cetera. But I suppose question for me is, who's in charge here? Is big tech in charge or governments? And we've been too sort of enamored by the promises of big tech. You know, for example, you know, I think Uber, for example, has deregulated industrial relations more than John Howard ever did with workshops. And so I think there's a real challenge here for people such as yourself that are in Parliament. Who's in charge?
Yeah.
And how do you see that challenge in amongst all the things we just discussed?
There was a real moment of sort of technological utopianism coming into, I reckon, around 2000 that went up until about 2010 when, you know, it felt like big social problems were going to get solved by technology companies and there was lots of exciting innovation and, you know, we saw a different future. And that is not what's transpired at all over the last decade. Instead, we've just seen these old school monopolies. We've had monopolies in economies ever since there's been free markets, and they all behave the same. They're big, mean bullies who destroy creativity and growth. They treat their employees badly if they can get away with it, and they don't deliver for consumers. And that's just where we've ended up. So I'm pretty focused on government retaking the reins here. And so I think there's some things we need to do. And if I can just, so I think the best example of this is what's happened in the US with the with Trump and the riots on the Capitol and this sort of stuff. And they're talking about how we're going to get misinformation off social media and all this sort of stuff. And still governments around the world defer to the social media companies to do the job. And I just reckon that's bullshit. This is not the way this is going to work. I don't want Mark Zuckerberg to decide who comes on his platform or not. They are monopolists. They dominate and host the platforms that are, hosting the majority of political conversation in Australia and overseas. And governments have a legitimate role to set the ground rules for how they operate. And I think governments around the world have basically abdicated that responsibility over the last decade, and we need to take it back.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting point too, because there's this sort of Kool-Aid that gets drunk in San Francisco that there's so this righteousness of, well, everything we're doing is fantastic, and if we break something, that's okay. Now, breaking labour markets has been enormously challenging for not just Australia but all over the world, but then also smashing up of social discourse. This is an unacceptable sort of situation that we're in now, and it's not dissimilar to the sort of environmental degradation you saw during the Industrial Revolution, where everyone sort of, we saw enormous environmental exploitation, enormous exploitation of people. And we said, no, that's not how it's going to be, right? The capitalists at the time, the industrialists, were told no. And I think we've kind of reached a similar point now. But question I've got is, can Australia, you know, we certainly punch well above our weight. We're a very important democracy in of ourselves, but, you know, globally. But can we stand up to these big platforms on our own, or do we need coordinated global action? Because it strikes me that, you know, to your point, there's this element of, oh, we'll self-regulate, but also we kind of tell us what we need to do, and oh, we need it to be globally uniform. And so they kind of thrive on the fact that there's friction between various jurisdictions, et cetera.
Yeah.
How do you see the challenge? Can we fix it here by ourselves, or do we need coordinated action?
Yeah.
With coordinated action, as you know,
it's hard. It's extraordinary. Yeah. It's really hard. And look at what's happened. I mean, the digital tax is the best example of that. Right. You know, it's in some countries' interests, it's not in other countries' interests. And so it goes nowhere year after year. So great question. I think it's got to be two strategies pursued alongside each other. The Australian government has been, so mainly through the ACCC, which did this thing called the Digital Platforms Inquiry, which was a big look at the competition power of the big tech companies and how we can address those issues. It's been a document that I know regulators all over the world have read, have looked at, and they're actually watching some of the experiments we're running here in Australia to see how this goes. So the news bargaining code that just passed the parliament probably in the next week or two. Members of parliament around the world are watching that to see how that goes. So we've got a really important role here as an example setter and an experimenter to show that this is some of the ways that we can think about handling these. But in the end, I think global action for sure is going to be required. And that's where this sort of interesting mix of diplomacy and technology is becoming really important. Some of the goals that we will have for tech companies will only be achieved when we've got global support. And so, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised in future years if our foreign minister spends a significant amount of time actually working on tech issues.
Do you think there's a case to remove anonymity from the social media platforms? Like, for example, like just, you know, you'd have a Twitter account, and I can only imagine sort of abuse that comes your way after you post a tweet. I certainly get plenty. It tends not to be from anyone that puts their name to it. It tends to be from, you know, knucklehead 486. like, do you think... I often wonder if you just remove the sort of cowardice from it. Like, if, you know, people wouldn't be prepared to say it in a, you know, in a room to a person's face. I think if their name's attached to it, they're less likely to say things as well. Do you think there's anything in that?
I do. I mean, I don't know what the answer is. I think that's got to be considered.
I know, yeah.
It's just... I mean, I think the issues around, you know, the economic impact of these companies... and, you know, child exploitation, like there's a bunch of things that are just absolutely clearly not acceptable. And those are the ones that I think regulation needs to focus on to start with. But Misha, something that's just really, really important to me is the social impacts of all this. And I don't, like, we can't allow our civil society to break down because of a bunch of tech billionaires say so. So, when, you know, you're thinking about anonymity, I think that's really important. I'm just thinking, maybe it sounds odd to raise this, but I'm doing this thing in my electorate at the moment where I bring together six or seven constituents at a time and we just have a cup of coffee together. And the respectful way that people treat each other, the kind of the kindness with which they deal with each other in person, it just makes me so happy. Like, they have such different views and yet they listen, they give their opinion, and, like, that to me is dialogue. And whatever's happening on social media is the complete opposite of that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, this is the thing that I really worry about, that there's permanent changes happening around how we think about each other as human beings, and that's, for me, the biggest crisis of all.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. There's something about the way social media and the interaction between politics, social media and traditional media and that tribalism that we're seeing for identity or whatever, right? I mean, you can cut it many different ways, but it's really allowing people to other others, right? And once you start to dehumanize and say, oh, look, I hate everyone who is X, and everyone who is X, you know, is wrong, you know, there's you know, Mike Murphy, who you may know, is a Republican strategist, who says it's I'm right and you're evil. That's yeah. what we've gotten to, right? Rather than I'm right yeah. and you're wrong, and we can respectfully disagree. And I it's good to see you doing things like that. I think we need to think about ways at scale that we can get people mixing.
Yeah. I totally agree. And it's all, I mean, I think about this as like Australians in different groups, little circles on a diagram. And there was all these overlaps in the past, like these things that brought people together, you know, their church communities, the union movement, their workplace. Yeah, and just slowly over time, we're moving away further and further from one another and having less and less that we see as having in common. And, I mean, things are not – I don't think things are at a crisis here in Australia. We're just a different country. But look at what's happened to the US. That's our cautionary tale. People are violent towards each other. Families can't speak to each other because of political differences. And we never want to get there. So it is a big concern.
Oh, it's extraordinary, right? People now in the United States, you know, in this country have been troubled by all sorts of things, race, racial inequality, religious sectarianism. But people now, the number one thing that they don't want people to marry into is the opposing political party, which is
scary.
Extraordinary.
So scary.
But, yeah, we can certainly dive into that one for a long time, although we're probably already bored everyone with our musings, but or at least I have. It'd be very interesting. But I want to actually just – we've talked a lot about, I suppose, the problems with the business community in respect to its treatment of labour, et cetera, and how do we you know, improve the standards of labour. But do you think the way we approach business more generally, particularly small business, I mean, is labour getting this right? Have we got the tone right? Or, you know, again, a little bit of an us and them narrative. I'm someone that believes in collaborating naturally. So, you know, you can't always – sometimes you do have to have a fight. But I think – you know, I always say that there's kind of two key relationships in your life, your spouse or your partner and home, and then your relationship with your employer at work. And it sucks fighting with your partner. So why at home? So why would you want to go to work and fight all the time as well? Occasionally you've got to say, look, we've got to have a serious discussion about this, but you don't want to be in constant conflict. So I don't believe in a conflict narrative. It's stressful to people. People don't want that. And the evidence doesn't support conflict, you know, when you have collaboration, you get better economic outcomes. So, I mean, do you think that we're getting this right, this relationship at a higher level, and then we can sort of, and specifically small business and Labor's approach to it?
I think we have a lot more in common with small business than people probably automatically recognize. And it is an issue for us because we've got to make that understood better. Partly because, I mean, you make some really good arguments about the workplace impacts of that. But, Misha, also small business is increasingly a preferred way of operating for a lot of Australians. So, I mean, there are lots of people who are technically small businesses who are actually employees, and let's just set that aside for a moment because that's an industrial relations problem that shouldn't exist. But there are lots of people who are working today who 50 years ago would have been members of your union who are now small business operators. Yeah. And like those people have so much in common with the Labor Party. And I talk to these, I couldn't call them guys because they are mostly men, but I talk to these men, they are desperate to vote Labor. They're desperate to vote Labor. They feel like their families voted Labor for generations.
Yeah.
But they say to me, like, I feel like Labor's making it hard for me to support the party. So when you hear that from people, like obviously you sit up and take notice. And so I do think we need to do it a lot more. But there's a lot of people, I mean, I think that's an accepted truth in the Labor Party today, and there's a lot of people doing really good work on it.
Yeah, and I think that's right, because I think one of the difficulties we've had conceiving the relationship with small business, you say, if you're a small business, we say, well, you're a boss. And really, small business owners a lot of the time, you know, they're guys or girls with, you know, with vans. Tradie with a van, is that really a business, or is that a working class person busting their ass every day, right? Same with like a franchisee. You know, they're like a small business. They're essentially a price taker from the bigger franchise network, and they're getting done over by big business. They're getting done over by their landlord, or they're getting done over by, you know, the power relationship. So likewise with tradies, they're probably getting done over by the big construction companies, et cetera, go belly up and, you know, phoenix themselves or what have you. So I agree with you. There's got to be more natural cleavages. And so it's interesting that you're talking to people that want to vote Labor, but they can't. So what do you know, is there one thing that you would change policy-wise to try to encourage them to step back into our fold?
You know, Misha, I think a lot of it is about it's about rhetoric, because they feel, I think some people feel perhaps alienated that when we talk about business, perhaps they feel that all businesses are being treated the same when, as you point out, like a man or a woman who, you know, has skills and drives a truck around servicing, you know, Coles and Woolies, for example, like they're a price taker and they're, you know, in many ways share the kind of concerns of an average employee. But I also think in total fairness, Misha, I think sometimes they feel we are talking about fringe issues a little bit in politics too much, and they actually want us to be focused on the basics of work, health, education. And when we talk about those things, I think many Australians, you know, immediately see that Labor's focus is their interests. But when we talk about other issues, I think they start to feel like, you know, we're not speaking for them, basically. And again, it comes back a little bit to class, perhaps, yeah. You know, what are the actual real concerns of working people today? And if they're not at the top of the agenda for Labor every day of the week, then you and I are not doing our jobs well enough. I'm just drawing you into my
This is the FPLP's deep problem. I'm just an observer.
Our problem, is it?
Yeah.
But it is an ongoing issue in politics for every political party that you know, to stay on the same page and to stay focused on the issues that matter most to the people that vote for you or you want to vote for you. It's easy to get distracted. And I think, like, for you and I who are, you know, centrists of the party and trying to desperately win Labor government again, because we know that working people in Australia need that, one of our jobs is to keep us on track. Work, what matters to families, health, education, like these are the core issues that we really stand for, and that's what we need to be talking about as much as possible.
It's interesting. I mean, one of the things that I, you know, and certainly wouldn't accuse you of it or many of your colleagues, but it does exist certainly perhaps in the broader, the party or the broader kind of activist set, certainly even to the left of us with the Greens, who then unhelpfully, to my view, pollute the discourse for Labor with general public. But do you think, I mean, I think there's an element of cultural disconnect. So there's a kind of, like I say, there are a lot of people in the Labor Party, unfortunately, that don't like the sport that working class people play. They don't like where they live. They don't like the jobs that they work in. They don't like their religions, but they turn and say, but you know what? You got to vote for us because we're on your side. And I think people look at that and go, are you really? And so I wonder, is the Labor Party becoming too narrow? And we can't be narrow, right? We've got to get 51% at least of the vote. And so if people look at it and don't feel culturally aligned with us, I think that's a big challenge. Do you see that at all as a problem for us?
I think it has been, but I really believe that after that 2019 election loss, which was just so gutting to every Labor person around the country, that really caused a lot of people to actually stand back a bit and say, like, and just address that issue that you're talking about there. And for me, it's a little bit, rethinking for me, you know, who's powerless in this society, or who has lots of power and who doesn't have as much, and who am I there for? And it's the people that don't have as much power. And, like, so my focus all the time is continuously assessing what we're saying and what we're doing and how does it sit with those people. It's almost like a rethinking a little bit of representative politics and just enforcing this constant reference back to the people that we care about, and anything that we're saying that, you know, doesn't matter to them. It's not that those things are objectively therefore not important, but I just think we need to keep our focus on what are we here for as a political party. It's to share the great prosperity of Australia with every single person in our country, to get people out of poverty, to help working families live an actual existence rather than just desperately make ends meet from week to week. And those are the things we need to focus on. And I actually think I think that was a reckoning, the 2019 election, and we actually have made some really big changes in thinking about how we do politics as a consequence. But what do you think? I mean, you're sort of a bit more outside looking in, very close to us all, of course, but do you see a change?
I'm the one to ask the questions on this show. Yeah. Showing your podcast. Look, I mean, I think people are alive to it in a way that perhaps we, you know, I think people are increasingly asking these questions. But I still worry that we still haven't fully absorbed all the lessons. But I think people are asking the right questions about, you know, and look, not to plug right stuff again, but if you look through that, you look about people asking questions about what's our relationship with faith, traditionally, certainly in New South Wales, and you know, Labor Party is built on Catholicism, right? Working class Catholics was the beginning, and then it was other second wave migrants like my family, in terms of Greek, Russian, Orthodox, and those. And so suddenly, if you haven't got a place for those people, it becomes difficult, right? So I think increasingly, those questions are being asked, but I don't know whether or not we've arrived at the answers. But conversations like this hopefully do help. But it is really great, Claire, I think, to hear you talking about these issues and sort of letting, and I think the reflectiveness, I've certainly seen a lot of reflection in a lot of people in the broader movement about what happened in 2019. And so, we keep asking the right questions. Hopefully we'll arrive at those answers. But I don't typically do this on the show, but it's sort of, with you being on at this particular time, I wanted to ask you about parliamentary culture. I think it's, whilst there's been these shocking events detailed in the last week or so, and these allegations that have come through, deeply troubling. I mean, as a woman leader in the parliament, in the community, I mean, what do you make of it? What should we make of this issue? And does it speak to, you've already made public comments, so I'll ask you to expand on about, what does this say about the culture of our politics? And then, well, how can we fix it?
This has been such a shocking incident to happen in the parliament. And, there's sex scandals in politics from time to time. This is not a sex scandal. Someone was raped in our workplace. Right. And that's just, if any member of parliament is not standing back and asking some really hard questions about how that happened, then they shouldn't be working in this building. So it's a core issue that we need to focus on. And I guess what I've observed about the process here is that, you go into a lot of workplaces, Misha, and the process is easy to talk about and it's easy to fix. We can write down on a piece of paper how things are going to be different and we can all agree that, this is how things will go forward. But the really difficult part of this is cultural issues that pervade how we do politics in this building. And unfortunately, this building, I think, has not kind of caught up with the 2020 Australian outside world. And I think, it's very male-dominated. Most of our political leaders are male. The worst impacts are actually on our staff, because even though there's a lot of focus, in particular in the Labor Party, on, how many female MPs there are, the staff are very vulnerable in this situation, in this building, and at a staffing level, the vast majority of senior positions are occupied by men. And unfortunately, it's just left this really kind of blokey culture. And if there's a blokey culture that's not, misogynistic and leading to a situation where people can get sexually assaulted in their workplace, okay, fine. But this is clearly a problematically kind of misogynist culture in the building. And so what I'm sort of trying to get members of parliament to do is actually, we drive the culture here. We are responsible. And the thing that's really annoyed me in the debate about this is people like the Prime Minister, saying, oh, the culture in Parliament's terrible, it's got to change. And he's in charge of the culture in this building. And what I really want to see is the leaders of our country standing up and saying, I'm listening and I'm shocked and I know that I need to change and here's how I'm going to behave differently to try to fix this problem. But no one said that so far. Everyone's pointing the finger at someone else and commissioning a new report or review every day to try to kind of kick it down the road. And I just think, that's how you manage a political issue. This is not a political issue. Someone allegedly committed a horrible crime in this building and apparently it wasn't the first time. So can we just step back from the bullshit politics and actually really try to solve this problem? Because it can't continue like this.
How do you get lasting change, right? Because I completely agree with you. People sort of say, what's culture? Well, fundamentally, it's what standards people set, what they will accept and what they won't accept, right? That's it.
Yeah.
That's all culture really is. I mean, it kind of is unspoken, but they're the parameters that we kind of learn or understand based on what we see around us. you know, some previously there's been these sort of attempts at resetting the culture in Parliament. You know, there's been unfortunately issues, you know, where there's been suicide. And, you know, people have then said, oh, we need a new, better way of dealing with one another within a day. You know, the example I read recently was, you know, speaking on a condolence motion, Tony Abbott, when he was health minister, got up and said, oh, this is shocking. We need to be kinder to one another. And then the next day he'd been next day was the first minister in 40 years to be tossed out of Parliament for yelling abuse at his opposite. So how do you get out of just falling back into those old habits? What actually, you know, can change it?
Well, I mean, I think the process stuff is going to be important, but the fundamental thing is people actually being real leaders and changing their behaviour. And one of the things I've been a bit frustrated by in the Parliament's dealing of this is that this is kind of being pushed into women's laps. And, you know, the Prime Minister's, you know, he turns to women to do these reports about culture and that sort of thing. And I really feel that's a little bit unfair because sexual assault's not a female problem. Like, often the victims are women, but the perpetrators of this crime are by and large male.
Great.
And I just think, like you're a great guy, Misha, and you are involved and in different environments, and I'm sure that you do the right thing when things get to a place that's inappropriate, when guys are there on their own and there's no women around. I don't think that's happening enough in this building. There's a lot of amazing guys that work here who are doing so much to help women, but the prevailing culture isn't that, it's something else. And I just want us to all actually work on this together and not see this as a female problem that women have somehow got to solve, because the problem isn't women's vulnerability, it's that there's people in this building who are clearly feel entitled to commit a crime and face no accountability for it. And like the worst thing is this guy who allegedly perpetrated this crime, he basically the crime was covered up for almost 2 years by people around him in the Prime Minister's office. And so that just shows you everything you need to know. Like, this is a system that protects people who, you know, a man in this instance who allegedly assaulted a woman. So we need to do a lot more on it. And it is about individuals in the Parliament. Like, cultural change, it comes from the top. It's got to be the most senior politicians in the country standing up and saying, I'm not going to just call a bunch of reviews. I'm going to ask what I've done to allow this to happen and how I can fix it myself.
Well, it's incredibly well put, and I think a lot for us to all collectively reflect on. So, you know, I think that it's one at the moment, I think people are really shocked, and hopefully this is a turning point.
I hope so, yeah.
It's a very heavy point for me to segue to what is the inverted commas fun part of the show, as I like to call it. Everyone's been on tender hooks waiting for the patented barbecue question of diplomates. So, Claire O'Neill's barbecue, you're an Australian guest, so you've got to pick three foreigners. Who are they and why?
Oh, right. Okay, great. All right. Well, I will go with Angela Merkel.
Cool.
Kamala Harris. And we need some levity. Maybe Bill Murray.
I was going to say
something. Oh, I know who I would go for, actually. Kristen Wiig, the comedian. Okay. Or Tina Fey. Oh, so many options to choose from. Yeah, I'm going to go with Tina Fey. So Angela Merkel, Kamala Harris, and Tina Fey.
Tina Fey can do an impersonation of various other politicians as well.
So we'd end up having many more people in our barbecue.
Well, I was going to say your first two were strong female political leaders, so you must work in politics. So if I didn't know, is there anything particular about those three that appeal?
Well, I think Angela Merkel is just truly an amazing human being. I mean, she is amazing. There is no one who has done more to shape Europe in the last 30 years than her. I really like that she's got her own leadership style and she doesn't try to change herself. You know, she's a quiet, sort of quite introverted person who doesn't, you know, politics is like, you know, people say politics is show business for ugly people. Well, that's, you know, Angela Merkel's like totally rejected that. She just is there to do her job. And I just respect her so much. And
very German in that sense,
yes.
Right?
Exactly. And Kamala, of course, like such a cool person. And, right. you know, I'm really fascinated to just see where this goes with her as vice president. And it's a huge thing to have her in that position. And, yeah, I just think
the first black woman. She's also a migrant background.
Yeah.
Right? So it's quite an extraordinary story.
Yeah, exactly. And apart from all of her achievements, she just seems like such a cool person to have at a barbecue. And sure. Tina Fey, I just love. I don't know if anyone's read Bossy Pants, Tina Fey's autobiography, but it's just the funniest book, and she's just such a cool person.
As I said, if she's going to be there, she has to do her Sarah Palin impersonation.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, anyway, Claire, it's a sitting day, so I'll let you get back to your actual job. But, look, thank you so much for joining us on the show. It's been a fascinating chat, and no doubt we'll see you on our TV screens and on our podcasts in the very near future. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Misha. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
G'day, Diplomates fans. I hope you enjoyed that episode with Claire. If you want to hear more from Claire, please tune in to her podcast. It's a really outstanding podcast. It's called The Long View. It's lots of deep dives into various policy areas and important policy areas affecting Australian politics. So jump on, listen to it. Won't be disappointed. As usual, I'm going to answer a question. A question was sent to me via Twitter from Peter. Peter's asked me, what's been the most interesting part to you of Joe Biden's presidency so far? A lot of different areas. I mean, the big focus at the moment is clearly on the stimulus bill. But the one area I would actually encourage people to take a look at is the review that Joe Biden's ordered of a 100-day review of the vulnerabilities in the U.S. supply chains to look at the dependency the United States has on increasingly China-dominated supply chains in manufacturing. I think that's going to have profound implications. The initial review is going to look at computer chips, medical equipment, battery capacity, and rare earth. And, so they're going to look at a number of sort of vulnerabilities. And it's going to have, I think, profound implications for security policy, but profound implications for trade policy. And, Australia has similar vulnerabilities. Effectively, every country has these vulnerabilities. But Australia has very similar vulnerabilities that were highlighted through COVID-19. Obviously, when we had shortages of face masks, hand sanitizer. But it goes right through our entire supply chain. I think everyone would be quite shocked just how reliant we are. So I think that's going to have profound implications for all sorts of things. But there will also be opportunities for Australia within that. For example, with rare earth. Australia is the largest producer of rare earth outside of China. We have a lot more capacity to scale that up. And obviously as well, we should be looking to make other industries out of that, be it computer chips, battery technology, etc., not just digging and shipping rare earth, but we can also be the world's dependable supplier of that and other products. So check that out. Follow that issue. I think that's a big sleeper issue that could cause a lot of interesting follow-on in policymaking. Otherwise, I'll see you all next time. If you aren't already following me on Twitter, it's at Misha Zielinski, at Diplomate Show. You can check out the show notes. It's all in there. I've also linked to Claire's podcast. See you all next time. Rate the episode, and I'll see you next time. Cheers.
You were just listening to Diplomates, a geopolitical chinwag. For more episodes, visit www.diplomates.show or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or through any of your favorite podcast channels.
This podcast was brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Mintz.